Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. Today, we are dropping the second installment of The Merge. This is a chance for you to hear from our top experts at the Mitchell Institute about key aerospace issues that are making headlines in Washington, D.C. and beyond. Our goal here is to cut past the sound bites and give you unique insights regarding the underlying issues at play. So with that, I'd like to introduce Mitchell Institute Dean, Lieutenant General David Zeptula.
Hey, Slick. Great to be back this week.
Our Executive Director, Doug Berkey.
Hey, Slick. Thanks.
Mitchell's Director for Future Concepts and Capability Assessments, Mark Gunzinger.
Hey, Slick. Looking forward to the session.
And Senior Fellow, Heather Penny.
Slick, great to be back. And gentlemen, as always.
Guys, thank you so much for being here today. All right, to kick things off, I'd like to begin the conversation with the Bomber Task Force missions. We've heard a lot about these in the news lately, and we just saw the B-2 and the B-1s deploy to Europe, and these crews are making headlines wherever they go. So, Gonzo, can you start us off? What's the idea with these missions, and why is it something we should track?
Slick, that's the number one question I'm asked on Bomber Task Forces. I'll make two quick points to kick it off. First, the short answer is they're a very tangible way of demonstrating that the Air Force is ready to respond to any hotspot in the face of Earth with lethal forces necessary and do it within 24 hours or maybe a bit more, depending on what kind of response is needed. And they're exactly the right kind of capability that theater commanders need to assure our allies, deter great power aggression. So just look where BTS have flown over the last 18 months or so. Portugal, the United Kingdom, Norway over Iceland, Hungary, the Baltic Sea, Middle East, Guam, South China Sea, and even off the coastline of Taiwan. So they show our adversaries, our Air Force, our military is able to go on the offensive to defeat it, you know, Chinese or Russian invasion as called for by our national defense strategy. And no other force can respond as quickly, including the Navy's carriers. And my second point is, while I think bomber task forces really are a great example of what our Air Force can do, they're also an example of how it's taking maximum advantage of a bomber force that really fits today into the low density, high demand category. Mitchell has said for years, the bomber force is the smallest and oldest the Air Force has ever had since it became a separate service. But, you know, it's hit a new all-time low with a recent retirement of 17 B-1s. As we speak, the Air Force has only 86 primary mission bombers on the ramp.
Man, I'll tell you what, Gonzo, that number of 86 is so disheartening. I mean, when you talked about the bombers and the bomber task force and their presence and all of the operations they've done across the globe, it's clear that bombers are really a swing force. They provide the global flexibility that we need to have to be able to service all of our global commitments across the world, right? But as small as they are, it means they're a high demand but low density asset. So even though they're flexible, you can't have 86 bombers in all areas of the globe at once. And that's really concerning to me. Global Strike's really stretching themselves to meet COCOM demands. And that's going to have a deleterious effect on the readiness of the force. We need more bombers faster.
Yeah, meanwhile, let me just remind everybody that we've got over 7,000 tanks in the United States inventory. And it's not just because we have 7,000 tanks, we're still producing them. How do they work in swinging from one theater to another?
Yeah, I'd like to point out that there is a silver lining to this cloud, and that is the B-21 is just entering production, early production, and we're going to see, hopefully, up to 125 B-21 stealth bombers in the force, possibly even more in the future.
Gonzo, we need to see a lot more than 120.
I agree.
Like we've said before,
I agree.
We get the first one on the ramp is a little bit too premature to talk about total numbers. But, 180 is the minimum force as far as I'm concerned on B-21s.
Absolutely. And let me just add that while production will ramp up over the 20s, the fact of the matter is we're not going to have significant numbers of operational B-21s in the force until, mid-2030s and on. So the gap we have today in bombers is going to persist for at least another decade.
And another important point is, I mean, if these bombers we have right now are high demand, but they're low density, so we're flying these bombers a ton, we're wearing out the crews, we're wearing out the jets. This is peacetime, folks. I mean, imagine what would happen if a contingency were to kick off. So if we're stressed right now with peacetime, we definitely need higher numbers. They just can't come fast enough.
I think the key thing in player, if you listen to, you know, Gonzo, what you're saying about when this program is going to ramp, it's right at the time when I would expect budgets to get extremely tight, because obviously the pressures of COVID and everything on federal spending, it's going to have an effect on defense spending. And there's so many other programs in the Department of Defense that are ramping because everybody delayed so much modernization because of Iraq and Afghanistan. And the Air Force is certainly the poster child of that. And so you got to ask, what's plan B without these kind of deals? Are we going to, you know, swing a carrier group somewhere? Well, those things move at about 20, 30 knots max. And are you going to put a division of soldiers somewhere? Well, again, that kind of moves at the speed of very slow logistics and can take over a month, probably longer in many cases. I mean, you know, remember the story of Kosovo, where the Army tried to deploy Apaches and they got in place and were able to fly combat missions after the war had ended. So when you're talking about the ability to project power and give a fast, flexible answer in 24 hours, that's a huge factor if we're forced to choose between different investment categories as a nation. And everybody's been saying it, but we've been taking too much risk and the bombers are too long.
Yeah, from the operator's perspective, the fact of the matter is there are our nation's premier means of projecting power globally. And by that, I mean, if there happened to be a short notice conflict, say in the Baltic Sea region, our carriers wouldn't be in position. And even if they could operate in the North Sea, their aircraft lack range to do anything really in that conflict. Bombers, on the other hand, can fly sorties from the continental United States on day one, if necessary. Strike sorties, then recover in the United Kingdom and fly additional sorties. And the same goes for a conflict, say, in the South China Sea or a China-Taiwan conflict. Our bombers can fly from the CONUS to operate, again, day one or day two of a fight, which is exactly what's needed to stop a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. There is no other capability in our military that can do that.
So Gonzo, you've worked in National Security Council, you've worked in OSD. Can you talk about how those kind of leaders would view this kind of capability and how they rack and stack their choices?
Yes, when I worked in the National Security Council, that was one of the highest priorities of the administration. That was to begin a new stealth bomber program. Not a standoff bomber, but a penetrating bomber that was capable of supporting our nuclear deterrence posture, that can conduct both standoff and penetrating strikes simply because of the deterrent value of that system.
All right, now moving along, there's been a lot of talk lately regarding roles and missions. This matters because it cuts to the core of ensuring our policy leaders and commanders get the most effective and efficient range of options. If our services don't align their efforts, we'll end up with wasteful duplication, unintended mission gaps, and efforts that spend more but deliver less. So we're seeing a lot of this today, and General McConville, the Chief of Staff of the Army, has pushed really hard on his long-range strike aspirations. And we see over 60 entities with their hand in the space enterprise, and there's a perpetual model of the Defense Department with four air arms. So I'd like to hear your inputs on what it means to be joint today and where you think this is all going. Money is tight and mission demand is growing, so we need to avoid wasteful duplication of effort. General Deptula, what's your take on all of this?
It's really all about using our multiple service strengths interdependently to yield a cost-effective total team approach. There's this thing called jointness out there, and unfortunately, too many people really don't understand what it means. It's a wonderful operating paradigm. It's really the essence of how the Department of Defense fights. In a nutshell, what jointness means is that among our military services, a separately developed and highly specialized array of capabilities is provided by the services through individual components to a joint force commander. Now it's his or her job to assemble a plan from among this menu of capabilities, applying the appropriate ones for the contingency at hand. And every contingency is going to be different. So in a sentence, jointness is about using the right forces at the right places at the right times. It's not about using every force, every place, every time. And in reality, and again, people tend to forget this, jointness requires the separateness of our services. And here's why. Because it takes 20 to 25 years of training and experience to master operations in the domains of air, space, land, sea, and littorals. So our notion of joint operations requires that we do have the strongest Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Space Force, and Air Force in the world. But where jointness is threatened and precious and increasingly scarce resources are wasted is when one service tries to accomplish a mission that's already being effectively accomplished by another. And I'd tell you that this is the case today with the Army encroaching on the long-range strike mission of the Air Force. And with budget pressures and growing demand signals out there, this means the topic's more important than ever. And as you kind of alluded to in your remarks, it's not just long-range strike where this is an issue. For example, there's an unwillingness to consolidate space organizations into the Space Force. That requires attention. Now, to give you an example of where there's some goodness being done in this regard, the Marines have made some bold moves in this regard by divesting their tanks. They recognize that they don't need to duplicate those 6,000, 7,000 tanks in the Army. We've got enough tanks, so it's good for them to focus elsewhere. Bottom line in all of this is cost per effect needs to be a decider to ensure that we don't do excessive duplication of effort. And to do this, the DoD's top civilian and military leadership need to drive more discipline into the subject area.
Yeah, I agree with you, General Deptula. I will tell you that jointness to me is somewhat service agnostic. It is about the right capabilities, right place, right time. And, you know, if someone has a better idea for how to accomplish a mission, achieve a set of effects, great. But in the case of long-range strike, as you cited, the Army does not. The capabilities they're contemplating posturing in the Pacific are going to cost far more than what it costs to kill targets. And it's the cost per target killed that counts by fighters and bombers that can penetrate and deliver weapons on the exact same targets the Army will attack with weapons that are far less cost. So it doesn't make sense from a cost per effect basis. It doesn't make sense from the kind of precision plus mass the Air Force could bring to the fight compared to the Army and, for that matter, the Navy.
Yeah, let me jump in here and also reiterate, it's not just about the weapon system. You know, one can make a case if you can do it cheap enough that, I mean, it's what the Chinese have done. If you can produce mass-produced surface-to-surface missiles very inexpensively, great. But don't forget, if in fact one could do that, you also need an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance system to detect where you're going to emplace them. And then you're going to need a command and control system to be able to control those fires and deconflict them from what else is going on. So the Air Force already has an ISR force. It already has a command and control architecture. And so what the Army is embarking on, you know, they're trying to get their foot in the door in terms of long range strike, but then they're going to want to dupe. They already are. They've already stated it. They want to build their own constellation of satellites. Why do we have a Space Force? Shouldn't they have a role in this? And what about duplicating command and control systems? So, you know, if in fact we want to build surface-to-surface missiles that can strike in the 1,000 intermediate range ballistic missile range, that weapon really ought to accrue underneath the Air Force that already has a resident ISR force and set of architectures, as well as the command and control force and a capability to control them. So You know, I'm not suggesting that we do that, but what I'm suggesting is that we take a step back and evaluate the necessity for moving into this area, given that we have declining resources.
You know, sir, what you bring up and discuss regarding the constellations and the resources and the culture and the command and control, it kind of gets back to the whole notion of roles and missions. And people talk about roles and missions almost like it's a derogatory term, like it's a pejorative. But the reality is that those roles and missions are really the consequence of our deliberate an examination of how to optimize and maximize the different domains of the services. So we can really truly exploit the capabilities of those unique services, the domains that they work in, and as a result, the unique cultures and command and control philosophies and so forth. And so again, it just kind of gets to the point where everyone's acting like a little kid rushing towards a soccer ball, trying to get those long range fires because that's the bright and shiny based off of China and the Pacific theater. But we need to take a step back and realize roles and missions are not a bad thing. And as a matter of fact, like, you know, for example, with the Army, they've got a really important role and mission. That's, you know, base defense. And so getting back to some of the bread and butter may actually be a more important element to not just achieving excellent effects, real joint operations, but really being effective in the battle space with that cost per effect.
Heather, you're exactly right. Imagine a soccer team, and everyone on that team wants to be the forward, or everyone on the team wants to be a goalie. That's a pretty sad team, and we really do have a joint team in our military, and that's why we have roles and missions. And there's also opportunity costs for the Army straying outside its core mission and trying to invest in long-range strike capabilities. It has another core mission, which is air missile defense. And our air bases in the Indo-Pacific theater, in Europe and elsewhere in the world, are almost unprotected against large salvos of cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, armed drones, you name it. Why? Because the Army hasn't invested in the capabilities that are mature and out there today that can be procured, needed to defend our bases. And the number one source of attrition of our nation's air forces in a war with China or Russia will very likely be their mass salvos on our air bases, on the air bases of our allies, too.
And well, a good example, Eric Gonzo, is look what just happened with the Iranian missile attacks on Al-Asad Air Base. Where was the Army in defending our U.S. military forces that were deployed there?
Yeah, that's the greatest current example. And there were some casualties. Luckily, there was advance warning, so they were light. But imagine salvos of missiles in the hundreds, not a handful, not half a dozen, in the hundreds. Over a period of days, and the kind of damage they could do to our air forces, to our ports, to our port facilities we depend on for logistics in distant theaters, to other critical facilities that are required for our military to generate combat power forward.
So I just have to throw this out here. It's so ironic because part of the Army's justification for their long-range fires is that they say that the Air Force won't be there because we can't survive the missile attacks on our bases that are inside the A2AD. Well, where does the Army think they're going to be, and how do they think they're going to get there? So they're sort of setting up the whole problem set, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, back to the bombers. We can again a point we've already made. We can fly from out of theater sorties into theater and penetrate and bring large loads of lethality to the enemy without being exposed, frankly, to air missile threats and so forth. But you're absolutely right. We're going to need the high tempo of sorties that our fighter forces can generate in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific. And they depend on those air bases, which are squarely in the crosshairs of China and Russia.
So if the services are squabbling amongst this, you know, we've got a new administration in town. There is Congress. You know, there are oversight entities here. How do those mechanisms come into play? Who's the arbiter here, and how should this get straightened out? And, you know, we've hit a lot upon the long-range fire issue, but there's also Space Force out there. I mean, we've just created a new service that is supposed to own this domain and be the excellent. in the room on this, and yet we've got all these subspace elements that aren't unified. So again, who's in charge here? How does this get streamlined?
Well, you raise a good point, Doug. I mean, ostensibly, one of the principal reasons is stated by the vice president to stand up the new Space Force is the fact that we need to stop wasting time, energy, and effort by duplicating multiple roles in space across a variety of different organizations. We need to consolidate them to achieve unity of effort. I mean, it's a fundamental principle of war, unity of effort. If we don't do it in peacetime, we sure as hell aren't going to do it. There's not going to be enough time to work the coordination during the next major regional conflict, because it's going to happen quick. It's not going to be a long, drawn out, multi-year activity. So you're spot on in terms of, you know, what is the forcing function going to be? There's no clear answer. There needs to be a unified effort in the context of the leadership in the Department of Defense to force some of these changes, but there are going to be fights. I mean, there's going to be fights with the intelligence community. You know, right now, and we've talked about this before in other shows, nearly $40 billion of the Air Force budget, Department of the Air Force budget, the Air Force has absolutely no say or control over, because it's pass-through money that goes to the intelligence community. So maybe the first step that we ought to do is gain some transparency into the actual budgets among the services. Pull that frappin' $40 billion out of the Air Force, make it a separate line item in the Department of Defense, and let's at least agree on monies that the services actually get to have control over. And then acknowledge that the Space Force needs increased resources to be able to execute the missions to which it has been tasked. So there's no easy answer. It's a very complex subject area and one that needs the attention before we get to a position where we're put in a corner and nothing becomes of this wonderful effort to stand up a separate service to focus and unify America's efforts in space.
Yeah, I like to address who could solve it. The Joint Chiefs could solve this problem like they did to a large extent back in 1947 to deconflict, but they won't. Now, General Brown has called for a roles and missions review, and I think that's spot on. The Secretary of Defense could solve it, but I'm concerned that that simply won't happen. I'd rather see this addressed internal to DOD, but I'm afraid it's going to have to be addressed.
Gonzo, you're talking about services.
Yes.
Joint Staff and DOD are not going to solve the intel community challenge.
No, not the intel community. The whole roles and missions, the question that, that Doug asked.
So, Gonzo, walk us through that a little bit more. I mean, so, you know, the spacing, like General Deptula is talking about, is complex because that goes outside of DOD. But let's take it back to long-range fires. Is that a role where the SecDef or Undersecretary of Defense actually has the authorities on that? Or who's the adult? Because if it's a service entity, they're going to play in their corner.
Yeah, the Secretary of Defense has authority to direct a roles and missions review, as does obviously the Congress through legislation. General Deptula knows this. He was in the last real one in the early 90s, and I led the last botched one, which was in the 2000s, the one that really didn't get off the ground because there's no interest on the part of the services to do it. But the Secretary of Defense can direct it. He can direct changes to the guidance that he signs in terms of the roles and missions. And of course, he can suggest legislation to Capitol Hill for changing a Title 10 if necessary in some mission areas.
Yeah, let me jump in here and offer that the services do not want a roles and missions review. They will fight against it with every ounce of capability that they have. And what I'm talking about is the services other than the Air Force. The pragmatic answer is that the Secretary of Defense, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, goes, no, we're not putting that in our budget request when it comes to funding, encroachment, and funding these long-range strike systems in the Army. That's the pragmatic way to do it. It's good. No, we're not putting it in the president's budget.
Okay, I've got one final issue to throw on the table. The budget season's about to be upon us, and the Air Force leadership statements up to this point have suggested that they may seek to retire more aircraft. Now, this plan has been happening for years. The service tries to divest aircraft to free up resources for future investments. On the surface, it seems to make sense, but the following results show a highly mixed track record. Now, given that we have the smallest, oldest Air Force in history, this is a high-stakes game. So, Heather, what do you think about this?
You know, Slick, you know, you said that this was a mixed track record for the Air Force, but this has actually been a very consistent track record for the Air Force. Every time the Air Force divests force structure in the hopes that they can really invest in future paper airplanes or future production, they end up losing both the force structure and the monies that they planned for that future production and replacement force structure. So an excellent example of this is CAF Redux, which happened in the aughts, right? Where the Air Force divested legacy platforms, F-16s, a little over 250 of them, in the hopes that they'd be able to buy fifth generation aircraft with the savings that they got in out-year budgets. But then what happened was sequestration, and the Air Force never got those monies. And oh, by the way, they never got those jets. And they lost the overall top line for fighters forever. So every time the Air Force gets rid of fighters for paper airplanes, which, by the way, everyone always thinks is going to be cheaper and more effective, paper airplanes are always cheaper as long as they stay on paper. So it's a losing proposition. You get rid of legacy force structure. If you don't have the iron coming off the production line and sitting on the ramp that same year, you're going to be out of luck.
Yeah, I'll follow up with a term that is popular again, and we heard it throughout the 90s. We heard it in the 20s, and now we're hearing it again. Capability is more important than capacity. The fact of the matter is we need both today, increased numbers in our Air Force, because our Air Force has cut excess capacity. There is no excess. Yes, I'm all for investing in new technologies, hypersonic weapons, advanced stealth, and so forth, that are going to make a real difference in the next war fight. But we need to increase capacity as well. It's a fact. By the Air Force's own analysis, which they called the Air Force We Need, their numbers said that we lack capacity to do one major war fight against China or Russia, plus homeland defense, and maintain nuclear deterrence and other required missions simultaneously. Think about that. Our Air Force doesn't have enough force structure for one major war.
Yeah, and Gonzo, that's including the legacy platforms that we have today that the Air Force wants to get rid of. I mean, the fact of the matter is, like you said, we need that capacity, but the legacy platforms, you know, the F-16s that I flew, the F-15s that General Dubtula flew, those are not going to be relevant in really kind of any future conflict. And we think of fifth generation aircraft as what's necessary for that higher conflict. But if you just take a look at Syria, this is an example where what we would consider a low-end theater, not terribly contentious, if you will, all we needed was for Russia to park an S-400 there. And suddenly all of the legacy fighters were at risk. And so we had to commit the small number of fifth generation fighters that we have, F-35s and F-22s. And so this really is an example of why a silver bullet force does not work. We have to have both that capability and that capacity. But retiring legacy platforms before you have the replacement platforms hot off the line, ready to hit the squadron ramps, is really just your own cut.
Yeah, I'll give you a very simplistic analogy. It's like a relay race, where the first runner drops the baton before they get to the second runner.
I think if you look at the Air Force's track record too, you know, speaking of this notion of, has this worked in the past or not, just look at last year. So they put a lot of aircraft in the budget request that they tried to retire. They did that to supposedly try to fund the next generation joint all domain command and control efforts, advanced battle management system, which are important programs. I don't want people to think I'm against that or anything. They're crucial. And they also wanted to invest in next generation fighter aircraft. Well, what occurred was that their budget plan for JADC2 and ABMS, that was cut in half. The Next Generation Fighter program was cut in half, and only because some key folks in the Senate and House worked to lock up some of those aircraft divestitures were those protected. Had they not been, they would have lost across the board if they had gotten their ask on the retirements. And so I think to run up there and do this again is really playing with fire. And you know, folks in the service oftentimes will double back on us and say, well, you just don't understand. You know, this is what we needed to be responsible stewards of our resources. I'd say if you have the best hand in the Department of Defense across numerous mission areas in terms of the capability and capacity you have, you have an obligation to fight for those. And maybe you shouldn't be the ones taking the mission cut. Maybe somebody else should be. And here's an example. Sequestration hit. And I get it. There are huge budget plays. But because it was all executed with stovepipe cuts within services, the Air Force was trying to cut the A-10 at the very same time we were building new Apaches in the Army. And I guess this is kind of picking the Army episode or something, but this is a very relevant example. The Army is less deployable. It's less combat effective. It's less survivable. You name it down the list. So we're going to buy more of these things at the same time we're going to kill the A-10, which wins hands down across the board. And so we've got to stop doing these really dumb exercises and start looking at across the board effectiveness and value assessments.
Yeah, yeah, I'll tell you a rule of thumb that I came to understand after just a few short years in the Pentagon and in Office of Secretary of Defense. Force structure the services give up will never come back, largely. OSD will say, thank you for those savings, Air Force, Army, Marine Corps. And we're going to use them for another priority, a higher priority of the secretaries, whatever it might be. If the Air Force does get some money back, it's directed. OSD will say, okay, you can get the money back, but you're going to spend it on something we want you to spend it on, not something that you've prioritized. Another rule of thumb, frankly, is you have to think of capacity across service lines, across the force providers, and not stovepipe. And that's a great point that you made on that. And when you do take a look at capacity across the services, you have to look at it in terms of cost per effect, not what a service needs, but what the department needs to maximize its combat power for the future on a cost per effect basis.
That's a really good point, Gonzo. And then, you know, the other piece of this too is that retiring force structure, whether that be legacy or everyone's all, you know, hot and bothered over F-35 right now, in order to be able to invest in future capabilities, is that, you know, really by their nature, developing new advanced capabilities is somewhat unpredictable. You're always going to have a little bit of discovery, a little bit of friction, a little bit of challenges here and there that you have to work through. And so as General Deptula said, getting rid of what we have in hand and the capabilities we have in hand in the hopes that we're going to be able to perfectly execute that next generation capability and, or even be able to accelerate its fielding is frankly naive. And so what we need to be able to do is mitigate risk, hold on to the force structure we have in the means that you talked, Gonzo.
Yeah, but I don't think any of us object to the Air Force retiring its old equipment. Capabilities aren't particularly well suited for conflicts with a great power and operating contested environments and so forth. We'd all like to see that, but you hit the nail on the head, Heather. Don't give it up in the hopes of.
Yeah, let me jump in here. I don't want our friends in the Air Force to think we're picking on them a little bit too much. They've got great insight, and they have to, the ones that are dealing with these issues. The challenge, Congress helps in some cases, but they hinder in others. The Air Force has got a very logical plan. Speaking of A-10s, Doug, with respect to the current force of A-10s. They're looking at what's required in terms of maintenance, manpower, and they would like to have the opportunity to retire some of the force, the A-10 force, not all of it, to be able to free up manpower to stand up the F-35 wing at Tyndall Air Force Base. Now, that's a very reasonable, it's not even a trade-off. It's having to deal with an Air Force that has much, much more mission assigned to it and expectations by both Congress and the Department of Defense than it has been given resources to accomplish. So Congress, you can't have it both ways. You can't say the Air Force can't retire anything and, oh, by the way, here, do some more of this. So they've got a very good plan in that regard. They're in a tough spot. And so they're looking at ways to be able to at least do this in a reasonable fashion. And it would behoove the nation for Congress to go through and allow them to do this adjustment. I know it's a very small tactical level issue when it comes into the adjustment of the entire Department of the Air Force, but it's a smart move.
You know, sir, you're right. The Air Force is in a really tough spot. And a huge piece of it is because the capabilities, the global capabilities, we were talking about bombers or the capacity and what fighters do or ISR. I mean, everything the Air Force does is in high demand. But virtually every platform and weapon system and capability the Air Force does is low density. And so part of this is also, I think, the nation realizing that they need to resource the Air Force at the levels that it needs in order to be able to meet its requirements. And so it isn't necessarily, I think, so much about how do we do those internal trade-offs. I mean, I'm a realist. I understand that those things have to occur sometimes. But I think for too long, the Air Force has been unable to articulate its actual needs, you know, the force we need versus, you know, the force we can afford. And Gonzo, I know you've done some analysis on this. Can you talk a little bit more about the budget?
Yeah, absolutely. And General Deptula was talking about this a bit earlier. Since the 1990s, the Air Force has had the lowest share of budget of any of the services. Now, I'm talking about the so-called blue budget, which excludes that pass-through funding over which Air Force doesn't have control that General Deptula mentioned. And its procurement accounts have also ranked the lowest amongst the services. For years now, the Department of the Navy has been buying more fixed-wing aircraft than the Air Force. And that just doesn't make sense to me. But why is that? Well, frankly, a lot of it is driven by lack of budget on the part of the Air Force and now the Space Force, because the Department of the Air Force now has two services, but yet its top line has not been increased. So now it's trying to support two services for the price of one, if you will. And that can be fixed by a reallocation of the defense budget across the services and, of course, by Congress.
Yeah, well, those are good points, Gonzo. Let me also offer sort of at a macro level, the services are going to do everything they can to meet the demands that have been foisted upon them and or expectations from the combatant commanders, for that matter. The Air Force, including the Department of the Air Force, between the Air Force and the Space Force, have really become the indispensable force for the conduct of joint force operations. There is no joint force mission that can be conducted without some element of the Department of the Air Force. And you can't say that about any of the other services. So the civilian leadership in the Department of Defense has to begin to realize that, you know, they need to go after, and the Congress needs to be aware of those mission elements that are high density, low demand. All right, let's reverse the case here. So not low density, high demand, that's not what we ought to be going after, which are air forces, but high density, low demand, like tanks. I come back to, why in God's name are we still producing tanks?
Yeah, you make a good point, General Deptula, about the services are trying to meet, you know, demands of the combatant commanders, demands of our nation. But there are cases, back to the very first topic we addressed, like long-range strike, where some services are trying to invent new roles, create new demand for their for their service.
You know, and maybe this is time for us to begin thinking about, do we have the right allocation of funding across the different services within the DoD? I mean, we already know within the Air Force that because we have the blue budget, which is dramatically smaller, I mean, Gonzo, and the numbers, what, like the Air Force procurement accounts are only 40% of what their procurement account looks like it is, because that pass-through money is taken out. So their effective dollars are significantly smaller. But when we think about how we allocate those resources based off of the National Defense Strategy and the military strategy, it's very clear that there are two services that come out as crucial to the broad theaters that we're looking at, and that's the Air Force and the Navy. And guess what? The Air Force is a big player in both the Pacific and within Europe as well. And so should we really be doing the peanut butter spread anymore? Maybe not.
All right, team, that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and insight on these topics.
Hey, good session, Slick. Thank you.
Hey, thanks so much. Great to be here.
Excellent session, Slick. And ladies and gentlemen.
No, thanks, guys. Appreciate everything.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.